Hi, everybody. Welcome along to Wednesday night. And for those online, I'm glad you're here. So we begin this course as we normally do by taking refuge together, setting our motivation, and saying a few prayers. And then we'll begin our lesson itself, which I'll explain shortly. So please just get comfortable in your seat. Try to make sure that your back is straight and your shoulders are relaxed. You can close your eyes, keep them partly open or fully open. And just place your hands wherever you like. And let your body breathe itself. And with your body breathing itself, just relax into awareness. And from within that state of relaxed awareness, imagine your environment being completely pure. The ground beneath you is made of lapis lazuli and it's crisscrossed with golden squares and flecks. The sky itself is full of rainbows and offerings. And in the space in front of you, there is a large throne. Sitting on it is the Buddha. And in front of the Buddha is His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and in front of him is your own teacher. These three figures are surrounded by all the other bodhisattvas, other Buddhas, and enlightened beings. And sitting beside you on your left is your mother, and your father is sitting beside you on the right. Friends and family are behind you. People you don't like, and people who don't like you, they're directly in front of you. And you're going to lead all the people surrounding you in the safe direction of the three rare sublime ones. But begin by recollecting how lucky you are, how fortunate you are to still be alive today. There are more than 60 people dying every minute, and we are not those people. So we still have the leisure and opportunity to attain our own spiritual goals. But we have to act quickly. Things are not quite right, and they don't exist as they seem to. Nevertheless, we have a spiritual friend who is guiding us towards the safe direction of these three rare sublime ones. So to make our offering of practice purely for the benefit of others, see yourself as clear as a deity, holding a Vajra bell and experiencing great bliss. And then join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. In response to this wish of ours, from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectars stream down, and these dissolve into yourself and all surrounding beings. and our negative karmas and obstructions are purified. Our health and lifespan, our virtues and Dharma realizations are increased. We're cleansed and supported by wisdom and love. Recollect the four immeasurable thoughts of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. Decide to develop these yourself and to establish all beings in those four immeasurable states. Then join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment to friends and hatred for enemies. In response to this aspiration of ours, from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectar stream down, and these dissolve into yourself and all beings surrounding you. And your negative karmas and obstructions are purified. Your good health, your long life, your virtues and Dharma realizations are stabilized and increased. Just relax a little more. And here you're preparing yourself to gather the merit needed for accomplishing your path. And imagine the field of merit appears in front of you. And you say, reverently I prostrate my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions, accumulated since the beginning of this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of psychic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. So to prevent clinging to the merit of creating as being truly existent, and to stop the appearances of the samsaric world, we imagine our body transforms into the universe itself, which we offer to the field of merit. And we say, this ground, anointed with perfumes, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four countries, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field of love. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. The Buddha accepts the offering, he smiles, and we look up and meet his gaze. And looking into the eyes of the Buddha, we find immense acceptance, humility, and kindness. Now, that teacher that you respect the most and have the best relationship with leaves the merit field and comes to abide above the crown of your head, and puts his hands together in prayer mudra and makes a petition to the Buddha and the other enlightened beings in the merit field. He asks that all enlightened beings pour down their inspiring blessings upon you and all sentient beings surrounding you, so that all perverse minds might quickly come to an end, that you and others quickly generate pure minds, and that all outer, inner, and secret obstructions are pacified. In response to his wish, lights and nectar stream down from the heart of each holy being, granting blessings and purifying. From this purified state of mind, you recollect renunciation, the wish to abandon all causes of suffering, bodhicitta, that you wish to become enlightened for the benefit of others, and the correct view that all phenomena lack the true existence they seem to have. But from the heart of the Buddha, infinite light rays emanate, reaching all environments and all beings. And everything dissolves into light. It dissolves into the Buddha. And he now dissolves into your root guru, your kindest teacher at the crown of your head. The teacher diminishes in size, becoming smaller and smaller. It enters through the crown of your head and descends down to your heart. Your mind and the Lama become one singular nature. The vast spaciousness, you hear the mantra, and you begin to recite the mantra. Now from your heart, rays of light begin to fill a tender exit of space. And every sentient being abiding within space is utterly transformed. And so the two purposes are achieved. And from the tender rectums of space, the light rays return to your heart. And you can feel your body breathing itself. You're aware of a seat that you're sitting on. You might be able to hear different sounds. You are embodied once again. And you recollect that this meditation was one of imagination, which has imprinted the mind with the possibility of you fully awakening for the benefit of others. So decide to rely upon an authentic teacher and to engage in your study of Dharma to bring about full enlightenment for yourself and for all sentient beings. And now, breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, and then you are in time with your eyes proper open. Okay, so we've got 5 weeks on this topic, approaching the Buddhist path. Today we're sort of doing like an introduction to the Buddhist philosophy. And over the next few weeks, we'll look at the mind and self, dependent arising, and how to apply the principles of what we're learning. When it's really speak. So, as I said, today we're basically looking at the meaning and purpose of life itself and how to engage in that life as a Buddhist practitioner. So looking at the meaning and purpose of life from a Buddhist perspective, and then this idea of finding a middle way. The Buddhists find a middle way between theistic religions and scientific reductionism. And finally, the importance of having a broad perspective in these studies. You two, in other words, what I mean by broad perspective is considering multiple lifetimes, which is a sort of not a common perspective that we take on happiness. We're going to look at what we call the nature of existence. So the Buddha explains the nature of our existence of ordinary living beings, whether they be people or animals, any type of being. If that being has not realized the nature of phenomena, if they've not realized the nature of themselves and the phenomena they're surrounded by, they are misperceiving themselves and the world. And out of that misperception arises the type of suffering which the Buddha calls samsara, or cyclic existence. The cyclic existence, in a real big picture, it means that you keep on being reborn into similar states, and you're always confused in those states. And the process just keeps repeating itself. It's like you're a hamster running on a wheel. You just go, you're sort of staying in the same place, and it goes round and round, then you just die, and then you do it again, and you do it again. That's the big picture. The smaller picture is that you have a mind whose thoughts act just like that. They go up and down and round, and you don't have much control over it. So this phenomena is called cyclic existence, or samsara. Now, while we are in samsara, what we're really trying to do is be happy and just try to avoid suffering. This, everything is driven by this wish. We want to avoid the sufferings of this cycle, the cycle of existence. So the purpose and meaning of life from a Buddhist perspective is based upon this idea of cyclic existence, samsara. So what we're trying to do within this samsara, or this life we have, is basically have less suffering and greater happiness. Now, then the Buddha comes along and he says, yeah, that's what we normally do, that's what people normally do. But in fact, we could actually eradicate suffering altogether. Now, which is quite a radical thing to say, because if you look at most of the psychologies we put across now, it's just, now you can just, you know, push it down a little bit. You're still going to suffer a lot in life, and that's just how it is. So life's purpose emerges through this idea of, first of all, wanting to put an end to your own suffering and be happier, but then saying, oh my gosh, everybody's just like me. So how can I bring about an alleviation of all suffering? So we're working here from the purpose of oneself, the individual, and then going to like universal. And the way that we primarily do this is to transform your own mind through what we call spiritual practice. The spiritual here means mental. Transform the mind through using the mind. When we do it just for ourselves, we call this renunciation, or self-compassion. When it's done for everybody, this is, and you intend to do it, is great compassion, but it also leads to Buddhahood.
Oh, it's a beautiful picture, aren't
it? Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, I was looking at this, I was just, sort of also mentioned too that it's like this idea that, you know, we're in the Garden of Eden.
Yeah.
And so I was looking at this as a metaphor, thinking, you know, so what are we to do with this garden? You go, well, to make it flourish.
Yeah.
Now you've got to become a real good gardener, and that means getting rid of the weeds and trying to cultivate the crops really well. So in terms of ourselves, it's like, yeah, we've got the weeds of the mind, the afflictions, and we have to become good gardeners with ourselves, you know, get rid of the weeds and cultivate all the good qualities. But I was also thinking, this looks like the Garden of Eden, isn't it, where the first people were, you know, they were really happy until they ate that fruit. That is the one thing they should not have done. So using this the garden analogy of sort of weeding and cultivating good crops, we have a path that creates a purpose. So the Buddha teaches that our mind shapes our reality and determines our state of existence. So the purpose of practice is to, therefore, purify the mental state. So in other words, that means to get rid of the weeds or the seeds, which are basically afflictions that create problems for us. We're trying to eliminate all these afflictive mental thoughts and mental states and the emotions that come along with them. To do that, we've got to become really conscious of those states, which requires quite a bit of study to actually work out what causes them. Because for most of us, if we don't know the Buddhist presentation, we think the causes of our suffering are coming from out there. It's other people and the weather and the bad things other people are doing. This is what's responsible for our afflictions. And the Buddha said, no, that's gardening in the wrong place. The garden's back here, it's your mental state. That's the primary source of all your problems. And that is something you can actually have a great influence on, where it's not certain at all that you'll have an influence on anything else external to you. But really, to begin to do this, to create this purpose, you call upon different, you might say, tools. One of them being ethics, and the other being concentration, and the other being wisdom. And so these, the concentration and the wisdom, the intelligence, in the beginning of the path, sort of focus on what they call the four mindfulnesses. So you suddenly become aware of what your mind is actually doing, what the mind is actually doing, how you're relating to the phenomena, right? What mental states and feelings come up. And by doing that, you determine what actually causes me problems, what causes suffering. How is my mind and body and speech reacting to this? And through that sort of process, you start working out, as well as relying upon the teachings as well, what works and what doesn't work. So it's through this mental cultivation which transforms our existence into something meaningful. And remember, the meaningful thing you can do is put an end to your own suffering and cultivate all your positive qualities. Even more meaningful is to do that yourself and help others do it. The highest purpose from a Buddhist point of view is to attain what's called Buddhahood or enlightenment. But this is when the mind has all of its qualities flourishing and none of the negative stuff can interfere with it. So I should also say to so there's two types of well, I don't know, there's two, but there's certainly one. So when you hear the word happiness, right? So what is it, you know, in our terms of happiness, what type of mental state do you think that is?
Joyful.
Yeah, it's sort of up, isn't it?
Yeah, content.
It's more excited. It's sort of excited. It's lifted up. And we feel sort of
buoyant,
and we feel really good. So I don't know, that's what the Buddhists mean by happiness. So I think their happiness is called, the word they use is peace, peaceful. And it's peaceful because the afflictions aren't there, the causes aren't there, and the afflictions themselves aren't there. So the mind is at the state of peace. Now this, from the Buddhist perspective, there's two different schools of looking at this. One is from the Sutra school and one is from the Tantric school. So from the Tantric school, this state of peace is pervaded with bliss. So it might be this like really uplifted, joyful state. From the Sutra perspective, it's just sort of equanimous, peaceful, nothing disturbs it. Well, the highest purpose arises through benefiting others. And the highest benefit you can bring to is to this enlightened state. This higher state arises independent upon a mind called bodhicitta, and a mind that seeks enlightenment for the benefit of others. And here's a quote from His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. He says, to free ourselves from the prison of self-centeredness, we learn How to cultivate immeasurable love, compassion, joy, and equanimity, as well as the intention to attain full awakening to most effectively benefit all sentient beings. So I heard this really interesting quote, because once you know a bit of Dharma, you can go, oh, you've got the major source of suffering, ego grasping, believing in a self that doesn't actually exist. We need to free ourselves from that prison. How do we do that? We need to cultivate immeasurable love, compassion, joy, and equanimity, which are the foundations in the Mahayana path for bodhicitta. They're describing the actual stages of developing bodhicitta and its final accomplishment to effectively benefit all sentient beings. Now, there's basically all the stages of the Mahayana path. So, do you have any questions about this? Is there anything interesting that you'd like to raise? Any qualms?
All seems fairly reasonable, so I'm just wondering, like, how come it's so difficult then?
It's quite right. It's volatile and non-consistent.
Yeah, that's how you said the vast majority of people are like that. That's how we are. Yeah, while things are good, we're good. When they're bad, we're bad. So we need to change that sort of way of being. So whether it's what we call good or bad should really make no difference. I mean, that's the ideal. Remember, good and bad are just states made up by you to describe mental events or physical events or events that we hear about. So good and bad really don't have any self-existence. In fact, nothing does.
And the real meaning of equanimity.
Yeah. So you see things quite clearly, and how they exist, you have a great sense of equanimity about it all. But, that takes a lot of training, of course. Yeah. So I think in answer to your question, I think it's just a habit. I mean, we are habitual creatures. We've done what we've done. And from a Buddhist perspective, over multiple lifetimes. So we've been misapprehending how things exist in our own existence for a long, long time. And so just to hear something reasonable, it's sensible, we like to hear it, it sounds right. But in terms of what we actually do, that's a different story. It requires quite a lot of effort to change ourselves. Well, especially in these times, I mean, you'd have to think it's in this century, especially the last 20, 30 years, that that we've had a much better understanding of how the human mind works, and the people involved in marketing and selling product have taken that and really turned it to their benefit. So they've really encouraged us to look more and more outside of ourselves for the source of happiness, for sources of happiness, and encouraged us to buy things, accumulate material, to be that happy person that we seek to be, whether that be knowledge or
shoes,
or, yeah, physical objects, not shoes.
So now there's a whole push for, like Sandy was saying, experiences rather than collecting things to gather experiences or to put effort into experiences.
And that was another, so I did that. So when I was much younger, I did the same thing. But no, it's like experience, I'll gather these. But then it takes a bit of time and you realise, no, wrong again. Well, because you find all experiences are Spanish, don't they? Yeah, well, that's right. That's what you find out. What was the point of that? That's what you ask yourself. And like you say, you try to recreate them or hold on to them longer or do them more often to try and get it. But if you just pay them attention to that, you just see the lack of value it has. It doesn't really have anything substantial.
No.
Yeah, it's very hard to do that, isn't it? To have the courage to do that or the wherewithal. And we find that there are a few people that have done that, but it's very rare. That's for sure. We often admire those people when you see what they've been able to do. But it's very hard for us. I think it was even hard for them, for most of them. And so it requires a great deal of courage. No, not necessarily. You could say, on one side, you could find a state that was both peaceful and blissful. Go, yep, there it is. There's that. You could find something that was neither of them, you could find something that was one, and you'd find something that was the other. So you'd say three possibilities there.
In Buddhism.
Yeah, if you did that sort of reasoning. So happiness, from a Buddhist point of view, arises or is generated from cultivating compassion and wisdom and realizing selflessness. That the objects don't have a true self, don't have true identities. And that's what you find like trying to gather experience. That's what becomes really obvious to you. It's like, my God, like it's not there. Yeah, so we're seeking lasting experiences and experiences that don't last. Yeah, it takes quite a while to sort of catch that. But then, even if we do, we go, hey, what can we do? If that's the nature of things, what do we do? And so for most of us, like, we don't know what to do. So this is where the Buddhist path comes in, because that's what they talk about impermanence and selflessness. This is the nature of all produced phenomena. They will all change, they're not stable, and they all lack an intrinsic identity. And so once you discover that, you go, so what am I going to do now that I know that? That's the thing, isn't it? What do you do once you have this knowledge? Right, let's do a meditation and then we'll go on to the second part. Okay, just get comfortable in your seat, straighten your back, drop your shoulders. And if you like, close your eyes and just settle into stillness. Your eyes are closed and you're breathing normally and naturally. Now bring to mind your purpose for meditating. And let your aspiration be to reduce suffering and to foster happiness, not just for yourself, but for all beings. So imagine that the mind you have is a large garden. And in this garden, there are areas which are tangled up with weeds of self-centeredness. There are other parts of the garden with fertile soil for love and compassion. So to cultivate wisdom and compassion is to tend to the garden, removing the weeds, watering with mindfulness, and nurturing seeds of kindness. This is your job. So what would happen if you were to care for the garden like that? Well, you might discover that love and compassion benefit not only yourself, but others. They bring you a sense of inner peace. They bring others joy and respect for you. So imagine gently putting out all the weeds of resentment or fear and clearing space for growth. So if you're planting ca seeds of kindness, what would you plant today? Perhaps a word of encouragement or a moment of patience or the generosity of serving somebody else a cup of tea. Mindfulness or recollection, knowing what to do. This is the water that sustains spiritual growth. We try to stay present and we align our actions with our intention to benefit others. So in this way, you might be able to garden yourself a sanctuary of peace. And breathing in, exhale, as your eyes start to open. But in the second section, of course, deals now with the Buddhism as a middle way between this theistic religions and scientific reductionism. So here I thought I'd bring up a quote, and this is a famous quote of the Buddha. It was in the Dhammapada, I think. And you'll see it often in other texts. It's about a conversation that he has with a group of village people called the Kalamas. And the Kalamas ask the Buddha when he comes through to teach, they say to him, look, we've had lots of people come through here teaching. They tell us all sorts of things. In fact, some of us tell us the opposite thing that the previous teacher told us. So what should we do? I mean, we like what you said, but like I said, you're only one person that's come through, others have too. So the Buddha says this, do not go upon what has been acquired by repeated hearing, nor upon tradition, nor upon rumor, nor upon what is in a scripture, nor upon surmise, nor upon an axiom, nor upon specious reasoning, nor upon a bias towards a notion that has been pondered over, nor upon another's seeming ability, nor upon the consideration the monk is our teacher. Kalamas, when you yourselves know these things are good, these things are not blamable, these things are praised by the wise, undertaken and observed, these things lead to benefit and happiness. Enter on and abide in them. So there's a really big, if you go looking for this, you'll see lots of commentaries on this part here. And there's also lots of misunderstandings that can be made by people when they first read it, especially if you just take out little sections or you stay at one section. So there's two parts in here. One is the first part, and then the Buddha's response, you know, saying this is what you need to do. So basically he's saying that we ourselves have to explore and think critically about the data that comes into us, what we hear, what we read, what we study. And then we need to apply it and see what happens. Like you're saying here, experience. It's only through your own experience will you know what to adopt and what to put aside. So I read a question about this, and what the person had missed out was, these things are praised by the wise. So it's like, yeah, you have this experience, but then you check it, because it's plenty of, I mean, we've all had experiences and thought we were right, and then found out later we were wrong. So it's to take this experience and now put it up against others. What do they say about it? But still at the same time, you have to sort of, you know, like you've had this experience. You're just checking it out.
It's like due diligence, really.
Yeah, so it's, you know, Buddhism balances critical thinking with openness to deeper truths. It's very much like, it's very much, it's like a scientific approach to things. You know, you have the data, there's some sort of experience that originally happens, and now you start asking questions about it. I mean, we do this right now, don't we, about more mundane things. This is the metaphor for this approach is like a scientist who uses both microscopes and telescopes. So you get into the detail, but you come out again too. Closely examining details while also considering the bigger picture.
The priest, well, the priest wouldn't be very happy with this.
This really goes up against, look at the time of the Buddha, was all organized religion. And it's the same thing. It's like, the Buddha wasn't, this wasn't like a religion, right? It was just a teaching. It's what I've got to say. So later on, it becomes sort of like seen as a religion. Yeah, when you yourself know, these things are praised by the wise. A little while ago, I ran into two fellows in the valley, not the valley, in the city, dressed like monks. They were monks. They met them in Sydney too. Yeah.
Were they going to a fancy dress party?
No, they just want your money.
Oh,
no. Yeah. And, you know, I could just see one guy talking to him and go, yeah, because you don't know, mate. You think this guy looks, because he sees he's a monkey, he looks like one you think he is. And this hair is going, wow, okay, well, this is how it works. But I mean, we could go further down. It's happening all around us, isn't it? People misrepresenting themselves, just look at politics.
Just look at influencers.
Yeah, influencers, it's happening all the time. We look at ourselves and go, I do that too. And yes, the Buddha actually encourages us to explore and think critically. I mean, that was one of the things I really liked when I first came to the centre, was that you didn't have to believe. You were quite, in fact, the Geshe's love you to debate and question. In fact, there's so many things still open in Buddhism. They're still arguing about it. So he teaches sort of a balanced approach that values clear reasoning and personal experience. But he also acknowledges that that there are aspects of reality that are beyond our immediate perception. Now, when you look at the text, there's lots of things like stories about pure lands, people transferring their consciousness to other beings and so forth. What happens after death? Now, there's a lot that you have to sort of think, well, I really don't know. So, like I've said before, how do you know anything? These are good questions to ask yourself. So, Buddhism combines investigation and experience to understand reality. Now, the reality, of course, is the reality they're really concerned with here is the reality of the person and the phenomena that surround the person. And what their question is asking, do these two phenomena, the person and the aggregates or the other stuff that make up the world, do they exist in the way they appear to us? Do they exist in the same way? Well, modern science says, no, they don't. They go, oh, it looks quite solid, but in fact, it's made up of all these little atoms and things like that. And they're all moving at a zillion miles an hour. They're coming and going out of existence. And actually, we try and put our finger on anything, we don't find anything. But then here we all are. So there's quite a disparity between appearance and reality. And what the Buddha's doing is like teaching us how to behave in response to that disparity. So this reality is, let's say, highly centered upon self and phenomena, but the phenomena is the mind. That's the phenomena Buddha's most interested in and tries to get across to us. It's not how mountains exist or how politics work or anything like that. Those are all realities too. But that's not the one that you focuses on. You focuses on your mind, because it's the mind that is the creator of it all. And in particular, your own suffering and your own happiness. It's the causal nexus right there. So he describes how the mind exists and how it functions. But one of the metaphors they use for describing the mind is that the mind is like a clear sky, like the sky is always present, right? With the, it's like it's always there. But at the same time, you'll know that it gets dark and it gets light, but the sky is still there. and there's clouds that come and go, and there are all these animals that move through the sky, and there are planes, and there's smoke. There's lots of stuff that happens, but the sky stays the same. It's always the sky. You see, this is the nature of mind. There's this mind, and it's like always there, but there's a whole lot of stuff that comes and goes. And we really get focused on what comes and goes. We focus on that. And so we're up and down and bewildered and all sorts of stuff. You know, there are practiced traditions that can have all that take place, and they're really on the sky level. So they don't react to all the objects coming and going. Now, they don't, most of us, I think, we really buy into what comes and goes, right? We sort of, they call it grasping or clinging. We cling to our thoughts, we cling to the appearances. But what are we actually, you know, if you look at what are we actually clinging on to? It's like you're saying these experiences, aren't they? And they have no substantiality whatsoever. It's like, you know, okay, then they're not there. So this middle way, I said between, you could say between non-existence and reified existence, between scientific materialism and a God-type religion-type thing. Right? The Dharma goes, look, neither of those. It's like there's a third way. And so this is like this third way where we use the wisdom and the practice in response to our knowledge of reality. And so you see that you know, in terms of the practice, sometimes it's called skillful means. And so you try to behave as skillfully as you can within this knowledge. And so, of course, knowledge is of just not your mind, but other people understanding it. But they might not know what you know. So out of the skillful means, it's skillful means, another way again, another temple is called and compassion. It's rooted in your knowledge that others don't know. But they behave as if they do. And so it's all messed up. What he's saying, doing the best they can. And they are. You know, so no need to do your best not to hurt them. They're already hurting. Everyone is. So we've got this wisdom and the skillful means or the compassion. What we need to do is like bring them together. Where we are at the moment, we practice them pickle-pickle-tickle, one after another. Sometimes they're wise, sometimes they're more compassionate, sometimes they're quite unwisely compassionate. Sometimes our compassion overwhelms the wisdom. So we need to sort of practice integrating our ethics, our mental training, and our wisdom. A bit like our three-legged stool. I try to get a three-legged stool, but it looked boring. So yeah, ethical conduct, mental training, and wisdom. In fact, Geshen spoke about this again on Sunday, didn't he? He spoke again. It's often now I hear him saying that the what are they called? The three higher trainings. He's often talking about the three higher trainings. But of course, the word higher and three higher trainings means that you're set on this liberation or enlightenment. It's not just, yeah, you've really got a great sense of ethics that keeps you really happy here. Or you can concentrate, make your mind feel really nice, but you're still here. You're here, of course. That's all about this life.
Yeah, he had a really different take on ethics from what we're used to of just in our Western world, of ethics being a way of keeping the mind calm and clear so that you can develop wisdom, which is quite a novel approach.
Yeah, you can. So I started thinking about this too, what he said there. So in religions based upon a god or a creator, the ethics comes from the god or the creator. We follow along with what that creator said and instructs us. In Buddhism, the ethics comes out of the wisdom. So the wisdom is the foundation for the ethics. But then the ethics helps you develop special wisdom, wisdom into reality. So it's like a bottom and a top end thing. Like the ground supports the roof. So does it say with the wisdom coming out of the ethics coming out of the wisdom? So you know when we talk about emptiness, right? So the flip side of emptiness is dependent arising. When you know that that none of us has a self that we think we do. There's a lot of things that we are actually empty of right? that we don't have, and we're all the same there. So realizing emptiness can bring about a sense of this equanimous state, the equality of all beings. Right? This equality can now get to the scale and now into the dependent arising. So out of the dependent arising comes the sea of going like, so what's the response, the natural response, I think, that comes out of realizing emptiness and dependency is, don't hurt anyone. No one wants it. That's the most basic ground of all. So there's your ethics. You can come right out of there. You can make it all up from that ground. No one wants to be harmed. Let's build up a sense of behaviors based on that. To me, that's reasonable, supremely reasonable to have that as the ground. But from there, again, so now this ground, based on reason, supports the actual insight into the emptiness, supports the mind in its concentration and its discovery of the deepest reality. So you can get, like I said, this, I mean, for me, it's like this understanding is, it's through, what could I say? It's conceptual, of course. But as I was saying last week, you need, the conceptuality is a relative truth. You need that to understand the ultimate truth. In fact, you cannot understand the ultimate truth without that conventionality. It's impossible. Now, yes, ethics is conventional. But it's the basis for discovering the ultimate truth of it. Yeah, so again, it's to have insight to allow your doubts and your questions to arise, but then respond kindly. Even when you're asking these questions to yourself, it should be rooted in a sense of curious and kindness. You don't need to be harsh to ourselves to ask these questions, nor to anyone else.
A lot of people who think they have the truth are quite harsh about it.
Oh, yeah, sure. Then you know they don't. that's the giveaway right there. So you don't know.
Yeah. So the cold, hard truth, that should be like a red flag come up.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, well, again, so this is something like the ignorance, the inherent existence of things. You know, there's many... when you look at the different tenet systems in Buddhism, there's only one that disagrees with inherent existence. So all the other Buddhist schools are really saying, no, there's something there. And if there's something there, then what happened with your friend, that's what can happen. There's a something there, and then you become more and more tight and defensive and righteous. But like if you said, that's what I think, I said, anyone who's really tight like that, yeah, you don't know.
So also,
that's what it tells you.
Another thing be that if the truth, as you see it, separates you more from people, then also it can't be quite right because that goes against the whole interdependence.
That's right. Yeah, again. Yeah.
Unless they're all wrong.
Yeah. You're all wrong.
Yeah, so it's... The understanding of emptiness and dependent arising should actually make you more and more relaxed and more open. And every time you get stuck, know that's where the mistake is you're making. Is you've narrowed your view. It's a narrowing. It's not actually like that.
But if you come from like a Judeo-Christian culture, the automatic approach to emptiness and dependent arising is to believe in it, not to have it as like a scientific basis that everything comes out of, but it's to just take another,
Yeah,
belief
so
system.
This is the thing. So, firstly, though, when you study the mind, so there is one of the mental factors in realization is belief. But a belief is not a correct mind because it actually doesn't know. It's a belief.
That's what I've been telling people for ages. It's like there's no need for belief if you know.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's what they can
It's like, if you believe in this, it's like, well, I don't have to. What are you talking about?
Exactly. So again, let's do our next meditation. All right, again, just close your eyes, and next time you inhale, just become aware of the in-breath, and then on the exhale, just release any type of tension, relax completely on the out-breath. On the in-breath, become aware that you're breathing in. And when you let go, just let go completely. We'll just do that for a few rounds, breathing in with awareness and letting go completely on the exhalation of breath. And as the state of calm deepens, create an altruistic motivation. Now ask yourself, could embracing the challenges of life unlock peace and compassion? Now picture yourself stepping into a garden of Buddhist wisdom. Here, suffering stems from ignorance. Through ethics, meditation, and wisdom, we can address both the surface struggles and their root causes. Transforming ourselves, the harmony we experience ripples outward. Our practice mirrors gardening. Critical thought uproots the weeds, the doubts, and the attachments. And our spiritual insight nourishes the soil. Impermanence, selflessness. And our consistent care grows the blossoms of patience and kindness. So whatever weeds need clearing, mindfulness is our weeding tool. So how would you nourish the soil of this garden? So reflecting on interconnectedness, dependent arising, feed the soil of the mind with compassion, kindness. And then commit yourself to a daily tending of your mental garden. With each breath, breathe out kindness. With each in-breath, can imagine taking away the suffering of the world. So let's nurture your wisdom gently. And you exhale, just breathe in. Okay, so it comes to the last part of the course. This deals with the importance of developing like a broad perspective. So I said before that what I mean by broad perspective is not just this life, countless lives, other lives are coming. This is a major difference between this religion and others. Well, many of the other religions, I think if you die in this life, you go to heaven or hell. And I don't know what happens after that. Most, I think it's like you stay in one place, but that idea has changed over time. Buddhism is basically, yeah, you could go to a heaven and you could go to a hell, but you're not going to stay there. You'll come out of there. Now, wherever you go, it's just like I said, you're on the hamster wheel and you just go from lifetime to lifetime, environment to environment, until you break free from that and attain Buddhahood. So here the Dalai Lama says, thinking only about the pleasures of this life and putting all our hopes in this life alone, we feel let down when things inevitably do not turn out the way we wanted. But this is very much what we were talking about yesterday, Sandy, you know, about wanting things to be different, but they can't be any different than what they are. While we don't have the wisdom to break free. We, like I say, the happiness you're seeking in samsara, that happiness is not there. Other forms of happiness are, but not the one you're actually genuinely seeking, the one that's stable, long-lasting, and doesn't change, where you're always happy. That's not here. That's not our present mind. Now, it's obvious is if we do not think solely about the betterment of this life and allow for the possibility of many subsequent lives, then when we encounter difficulties in the present, we are better able to weather them and remain positive about the future. Thinking only about the pleasures of this life and putting all our hopes in this life alone, we will feel let down when things don't turn out the way we wanted. Therefore, broad perspective of life and an understanding of the nature of dukkha and satisfaction and dissatisfaction helps us to improve our life now. Yeah, so this is good. It's one of the things, you know, like we don't like suffering, right? We don't like meeting misfortune and stuff like that, but we're going to. So if you can expect that to happen, it's not going to be such a shock. You know, they say, you don't get the things you want. In fact, you get the things that you don't want. And the things that you do want, if you ever get them, you lose them. You know, there's seven forms of suffering that they go through. You look at that, it's like, wow, you go, man, that's true. You know, you get what you don't want. What you do want, you don't get. What you do have and you like, you lose it. It'll be taken from you. You know, if you get your head around that, you go, wow, okay, that's the nature of things. I don't need to be unhappy about that. That's just the nature. Right? In fact, when that happens, I should go, yeah, well, of course. That doesn't mean I've got to be unhappy about it. No, not at all. In fact, remember that time, you know, I was surprised myself when this happened. I had this really nice pair of Ray-Ban sunglasses, $200 to $300. Well, I really liked them. And I was sitting under this tree out Sandgate Way. And I got up and I'm walking, I went, shit, there's my glasses. And I went back to the tree and they're gone. Right? And I didn't even go, you know, I didn't even have a chance to go shoot more.
Okay.
No tantrum, nothing, you know. And then I went, oh, somebody's got my glasses. They're going to love them. designed it, right? And as soon as I saw it, I thought, oh, remember the time I found that pair of sunglasses in the bank and just took them? They were just lying there, and I picked them up. It was like, well, then no one's here. I'll take them. I put them on, I liked them. Now somebody's done the same with mine. It was really great. It was like, wow. Just,
it's definitely
some losses
a bigger
don't.
picture.
Yeah, it's just a bigger picture, isn't it? If you just, yeah, so like it does work. You just got to remember to do it, that you can do it. And if you do it, you get a very different result.
Reframe it.
Yeah, you do the instant reframe.
So what's the difference between this and, say, the whole, say, with theistic religions of, yeah, it's suffering now, but it'll be better next. And that's almost like, you know, panacea for the people. So how's Buddhism different in that?
So when you say next, what do you mean?
The next, like heaven or...
Oh, yeah. Oh, a very big difference. You got to suffer now, happiness now. From a Buddhist perspective, your happiness is available to you like right now.
In the sky.
No, it's not pie in the sky. It's actually the mind is the pie. You just have to have a feed. But yeah, everything is it's here. We just don't. And the thing what I'm saying is, I'm going to say we don't realize. I'm talking about myself and probably people in the class, right? There are others who do realize it. It's not anywhere else but right here, because the suffering and the happiness is created by the mind. If you know the nature of your mind, just like I said, wow, normally I'd be suffering because my glasses are gone. Never, that didn't happen. In fact, there are many different in the armed forces in boxing, right? Man, this story about this boxer, right? So he loved to get hit. He loved being punched. Right? You know how much, when that happened, how scared the other people were of him? Like, this guy became a world champion because he got to appreciate the harm of the punch, the hurt. Like, he smiled. Right? I mean, oh my God. Right? So when I read that, sort of go, wow, again, it just shows you that where is the harm? Where is the hurt? You make it up, or you don't. That's the thing, or you don't. And so, you know, you can, I mean, he trained in that. There are other people you read about in the armed forces, they just quite often, to actually, instead of disliking suffering, liking it. And then it's not suffering anymore. Yeah, so we see just this next slide, this ripple effect of the perspective, right? And how this does this with you. So, yeah, so when we experience suffering in this life, right? What, from the teachings of karma, what should we do? What's our response to suffering in this life?
Celebrate, because
it seems to be. That's right, to go, great, like the boxer, it's over. That one's done. Who does it? I mean, no, that's like, no, that's exactly right. No. There is. And the multiple steps of the learning of it is to get the philosophical underpinning so you can go. So another one, I'll give you an example. So many, many years ago, when I was a criminal, a city criminal, I got busted, right? So I'm sitting at the table. The front door goes in, the back door goes in, and the police are just running in. It was just like the movies. And this guy telling me, when they come for you, Eddie, you can't move. They're there, right? And it was just like that. And I was going, wow, it's just like George told me, right? And they've come in, and my thing was, I'm so happy. I'm so glad this is over. I'm really glad this whole thing where I could not make the decision to stop doing what I was doing, it's done. Done by others for me. So yeah, I go off and I brought out you sign the confession. I tell you this and that. I go, yeah, sure. Put it over there. Yeah, the money's over there. Yep, the drugs are over there. And they're sort of looking at me going like, shit, like, this is a weird one. right? Like,
You're ready.
yeah. And then when I was in the jail, the other guys were saying to me, like, what's wrong with you? Like, don't you know where you are? But because I was happy. And they were all unhappy. They were unhappy to be in jail, and I was happy to be in jail. It's not the things, it's the attitude you bring to them. And a lot of those guys, at least three of them committed suicide. They didn't like where they were. And I was really lucky while I was in there to read a book called Man's Search for Meaning. And in there, Viktor Frankl, like he was the one that the biggest change for my life when I read that book. It was like, oh my God, you give the meaning to whatever's going on, to your life and to whatever's going on. And I thought, that's just what I did at the table.
No inherent meaning.
Yeah, no inherent meaning. Meaning is something you make up. Well, once you do it, you get the effect of it. That happens, that works. So with this big view, of other lifetimes, you've got to realize that whatever karma teaches us, causes produce their effects. Causes and conditions produce effects. Right? Any effect that you experience is a result of some sort of karma. If it's mental, I mean, the mental stuff that happens to you, that's a karmic effect. In fact, I like what Rabindra said. Every feeling you experience is a karmic effect. And you think about that and you go, of course, because something came before the feeling, then I had the feeling. Right? So just like you said, you have a bad feeling, you go, well, a bad cause that produces, it's over. Now, nothing random and there's nothing inherent. It just arises and it doesn't have to arise. That's the other thing you've got to remember.
Bad things happen to good people.
That's right. Just like that. And good things happen to the bad people, as we're well aware of. Right? So, because there's this long, long period you've got to sort of think of, right? Then, hey, resilient. Be resilient about it. You don't need to despair. It's like, it's got to go. But it can't stay there. It never does. If you try to really make yourself unhappy, like all the time, it's nearly impossible. You get little breaks. It's really hard. It's also hard to make yourself be happy too. So yeah, so these sort of things. So again, you come back to interdependency or dependent arising. Whatever exists does so dependently. And here, I think the most important thing of dependencies here is awareness and the language. It has the most deepest impact on us. Of course, our causes and conditions have a big impact on us, and things are made of their parts. But when you think about your part in it, your own awareness and your own use of language, creating the effects that you experience, there's where the power lies.
Yeah.
So dependent arising reveals interconnectedness, leading to profound insights. Now, of course, interdependency leads to you realizing emptiness, that all phenomena don't have the intrinsic appearances. They don't exist that way. So they have the appearance, but they don't exist that way. And having a really broad perspective helps you to see the interdependencies, how everything is related. Which brings us to this, that having a broad perspective transforms the adversities into opportunities for your own growth. So one of the things that I did in the job was I got my school certificate in there. I made an attempt at a university entrance. I did heaps of reading. I educated myself. I worked out why I did what I was doing. And then I decided not to do it again. And that there's going to be other things. In fact, it helped me decide there. I decided to check out all of well, I decided to go and see His Holiness. That was the thing I decided in jail. I'd ruled out all these religions except Buddhism. And I thought, but if they don't walk their talk, I'm not interested. And the only person I could think of was doing that was the Dalai Lama. So I thought, right,
A big
I'll check
test.
them out. I'll put them to my test. Well, this will help you, don't you? You know, it all sounds good, but if no one's doing it, what's the point? Yeah. And then suddenly you see, oh my gosh, there are these really decent sort of human beings. So what they're saying is reasonable. No, they're not. Anyway, so I've had a very useful. And another thing, as Holmes said, that I've maintained, like I said, so whenever you experience suffering yourself, realize your mind is narrowing. And what you really find it's always narrowing in on is you. There we have the source of suffering, self-grasping, grasping itself. It's all about me. And then you've got to go out, go back out again. So adopting this multi-lifetime view, like I said, brings about a greater sense of resilience and compassion for yourself and for others. And it really helps you understand why others are the way they are. If you realize it's not just this life that affected them, it could have been many, many terrible things that have happened in other lives. You know, of course they're behaving badly. I mean, we already know, don't we, how unskillful, poor parenting has a massive effect on us in this life. So, yeah, you make that on other lives as well, and their parents were really harmed and hurt, which they often, even in this lifetime, you find out that's what makes our parents so badly informed, isn't it? They were hurt themselves. So we have much wider scope for compassion. There are times really up, we'll do this last meditation and then we'll finish up. So again, just get comfortable in your seat. Have a good breather. Go. On the in-breath, watch, tension. Exhale, relax completely. So does your motivation answer why you are practicing today? Can you nurture the resilience, compassion and purpose to meet the challenges of this life? But imagine now that existence itself is like an eternal ocean. The waves are symbolizing challenges. They're rising and they're falling. Beneath them, beneath the wave, lies the sea's steady depth, your multi-lifetime perspective. By embracing this view, difficulties become fleeting ripples in an expansive journey. This view can foster patience and hope. Suffering is impermanent. Challenges resemble the ocean waves. Knowing the vastness of that ocean, it should greet each surge calmly aware that serves a larger story. You might ask yourself, what if our struggles belong to something greater? You can let the shift of frustration into acceptance. Can this view deepen your compassion? for seeing others navigate their own oceanic waves nurtures empathy. A shared current connects us. So keep this insight and meet the waves of change with courage. Have a sense of resilience grow with each breath. And now breathing in, exhale and open your eyes. So in terms of just, you know, a basic thing for being aware and being a Buddhist, just try to be aware and start with your breath because it calms you right down. Observe your mind. This is a practicing Dharma person. And do one thoughtful act for someone else. So next week we'll be looking at mind and self, and what the relationship is between these two. Body, mind, self, rebirth, two natures of mind. A heap. As you can see. I'll do my best. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of the Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme dual body chitta not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline but increase no more. And as long as space endures, as long as sentient beings abide, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. And now for the long life of His Holiness. The wish granted, wish fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. Rupa Shastra pretend, in holding and spreading the moon, these precious and complete teachings through explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience that is never discouraged. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you I make this request.